Hello, and welcome to The Spark. I'm Matt, and by the grace of the Nashville Public Library, I'm here to talk about the creative process and the joy of appreciating the creations of others. Thankfully, I'm not going to do it alone. Joining me today is the president of Nashville-based board game publisher Hootenanny Games. It's Alex Kimmerling. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, I was shopping recently at one of our many local game stores, which, if people don't know, we do have several of them. And they had a little locally designed or published section. And I was like, we have those? And several of them were from you. So I thought I'd call you down here and talk about it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for reaching out. I understand these stores are fantastic, by the way. I mean, they really cater to local companies. And I think that one was Game Point. Can I mention it on air? But they're wonderful people all around.
Mm. So Hootenanny Games as a game publisher, what is your relationship to the design and designers of a game?
Yeah, so this is the most interesting business that I could ever be a part of. Mm. These creators are just absolutely wild. I mean, their brains work in ways that I couldn't even comprehend. And so we meet with these inventors of games on a regular basis throughout the year. We probably meet with 100 more inventors, and they pitch us their concepts and whatever is new and different and has a cool mechanic, we decide to work with them. And we say, okay, we're going to create this game. We're going to bring it from concept to reality. We're going to hire graphics teams. We actually use a Nashville-based graphic design firm for all these. We're going to manufacture the game. We're going to make a lot of units and sell them all, market them all, get them on TV, you know, like do all the marketing efforts that it takes to really sell a product in America. And not only America, I mean, our dream is to sell it beyond that as well. Mm. But anyways, it's super fun. We're kind of the administrators on a lot of fronts, but we get to work with graphic designers that are on a just really, really high level. And it's so fun. I mean, diving into every detail.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that grabbed me immediately when I saw the sort of range of games that was available at Game Point specifically. And when I took a couple home and started playing with them, the like visual design and sort of cohesiveness is so strong across the line in my experience so far. And it seems like all of them are statement, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, how did that relationship come about? Did you know those people already? Did you just sort of go looking for a local space to be your design partner?
So Statement does the graphics for all of these games. And before Hootenanny was created by my wife and I, we had used Statement previously in like kind of a marketing role. They developed some graphics for us for previous trade shows and things like that at a company that I was at before Hootenanny Games. So I knew those people, knew how great they were. It was a pretty easy decision to say, let's see if they'll design some games for us.
Nice. And they've managed to do like a really impressive breadth of visuals, I would say.
Yeah, every game looks entirely unique. You'll see just, you know, wildly different design elements in each game. But at the same time, if you put them all on a wall next to each other, which we do have in our office/house, you will see that they all go together really nicely, and it kind of has that cohesive look that we really were striving for.
Mm. So obviously you've mentioned a couple times that you and your wife own and run Hootenanny. As I understand it from some previous interviews I was looking at, there was a sort of moment mid-lockdown where like, oh, your job seems more fun than mine.
Yeah, it was kind of a funny story. Like, we've always talked about running a business together and starting something, and we've always kind of had that entrepreneurial direction in life. But during the pandemic, we were sitting in side-by-side rooms on Zoom calls. And my Zoom call was with comedians writing content for a new party game that we were working on at my previous company. And Whitney was on a Zoom call, like, deposing a doctor in a catastrophic case because she was an attorney, and it was a very, very serious ordeal. And we both left our offices at the same time and saw each other outside in the hallway and realized that I was crying, laughing, and she was not. And at that point, we kind of decided, you know, we both need to go the happier route in life, and let's figure out how to make this happen. It took a little bit of time to plan for it and get it in the position that we needed to, but eventually we're here with Hootenanny Games.
And so at what year did you actually launch, and what was the sort of first or number of games that were at launch?
So we launched in 2023, and we made a goal of releasing four games at New York Toy Fair in October of 2023. And so that's what we did. We brought four games to life and debuted at New York Toy Fair.
Nice. And what were those original four?
It was Snarkus, Flitzmagoats, Sixum, and Versus.
Okay. Very cool. And obviously, we're talking about a very visual medium of board games. So if you can safely do so, listener at home, I suggest heading to Hootenanny Games' website to take a look at these games as we talk about them. But talking about the range of games you'll have in particular, it seems like you're specifically inhabiting a sort of party game space or like 8 and up difficulty space. What led to that realm being where you wanted to live?
Yeah, so part of it's marketing. Part of it's what our experience is. We have two second grade boys, so that world is a place that we live every day, right? So making games that families can sit down at the table and enjoy time together is probably above all our number one goal. And if we do our job right, more families get to smile together, right? That's a pretty good mission for a company. I can't think of anything better.
Yeah.
So we really strive to make games that kids will love, but parents also will. Mm. So that, you know, there's always that game that your kids pull out that they're like, hey, let's play this game. And you're like, no, not that game. Like either you've played it 10,000 times or it's just not that great of a game, maybe both. And yeah, so we wanted to create something fresh and fun that was really engaging. Maybe sneakily educational as well, but we don't put STEM on anything. I mean, that tagline does not necessarily apply to our games on paper, but if you play any game, you get educational moments in it. You learn about logic. You learn about decision-making. You might learn about debating in certain games, right? I mean, it's just really math is a key part of Snarkus.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like if you're learning addition, that game is awesome for that. So there's really a lot of opportunities to have fun. At the same time, Snarkus, while it's a great game to teach kids addition, it's also kind of based off of a game that was invented in the Middle East hundreds and hundreds of years ago, which was not aimed at kids.
Right.
So, like, you think about people like old men sitting around drinking tea and playing a game and then transitioning that to Snarkus, where, like, kids are sitting there having fun trying to win gyms.
Right.
So,
and I feel like this realm of game, like that difficulty level, is a really good sweet spot. Obviously, there are people who like really crunchy board games, but at least for me, I personally don't have like a dedicated board game group. And typically, I'm just the person who like will bring a couple games to family gatherings or what have you. And particularly for people who don't play a lot of games, something like these are a lot easier to teach than a lot of things and easier to sort of get people into that space.
Yeah, absolutely. We really want to make games that are so easy to teach, that have very few rules, but those, you know, once you're in the game, you are fully in the game, right? Like you want to be a part of it. And if there's only a minute worth of rules to learn, even better. Like let's get that box open and let's be playing that game as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely our philosophy.
And I feel like to the point of when you're in the game, you're in it. Immersion is a weird thing to talk about with board games to a certain degree, I feel like, because the other piece of it that we were talking about a second ago of it being a very social thing of like humans are weird in that we can be fully immersed in a game that we're playing that's just bits of cardboard and paper on a table while also being immersed in the people around us. Like that suspension of disbelief is so strong.
That's right. And it's I know this is not role-playing games at all. But at the same time, like there's a little bit of that in anything that you play. If you're playing Monopoly, you're like, oh, I'm going to buy your house. It's very...
Yeah, you're role-playing a robber baron.
Yeah, you absolutely are. And so there's a lot of that in any game. Mm-hmm. I think as long as you care about it and you're passionate and having fun, then that naturally comes about.
And there are a lot of games where it's more fun if you just sort of lightly role play. Like I always think about playthroughs I've seen of games like Sheriff of Nottingham, where like every round someone is inhabiting the role of the Sheriff of Nottingham, you know, inspecting the goods that someone wants to bring into Nottingham. And when they play up the, like, you know, throwing their weight around a terrible despot, that role is supposed to be, because you're supposed to inspire a sort of fear and obeisance in your players. The design influences the incentive to role play.
Yeah, yeah. And then we also have games where there's no role playing whatsoever, but it still has those, like, gotcha moments where you might not be playing a character or anything, but when you have a chance to mess up somebody else's board, particularly in Six'em or dice game, you could erase an X off of somebody else's board and completely mess with their entire strategy. And when you do that, you're like, oh, yeah, got you. You know, like, in that moment, really just drives friendships either into the ground or makes them better.
Right. It is the crucible.
That's right.
So I don't know if you want to talk at all about how you were in the game industry before Hootenanny.
Yeah. So before Hootenanny, I worked for a company called Big G Creative. Mm. And we made a lot of licensed games, a lot of signature games as well. But the most recognizable games would probably be the Bob Ross games.
Oh, sure.
If you've seen those. Mm-hmm. That was us at Big G. And we also did a Kenny G game called Keeping It Saxy. And a Home Alone game, Carpool Karaoke. And then we had an awesome signature game called By Felicia.
Oh, yes.
Which was one of my favorites. But yeah, so I worked with a lot of these incredible inventors, worked with a lot of graphic design firms, really got to learn the space, learn our factories, meet with our factories in China, and understand the whole logistics and operations and finance and, like, all the ugly parts of the industry.
Right.
And that's what makes people successful, is understanding not just what you see in front of you on the table, but all the stuff behind it that makes it possible. And really, Whitney runs this company with me, and she is the opposite of that. She knows everything about the visual components and loves getting all of those details perfect, right? And so even though her background's in the legal profession, she brings this whole just absolutely expertness approach to getting all the design elements right in a game and making sure all the rules are perfect and, you know, that the fun is there and all that. So together, if you take the logistics and operations for me and her knowledge of everything pretty and put it together, somehow it makes Hootenanny Games work.
Nice.
But it's pretty cool. We complement each other.
Mm. Yeah, a really inherent part of good collaboration is, you know, inhabiting different roles successfully. Presumably, you spent some time with games, you know, before working in the industry in terms of, like, playing them yourself. What do you get out of games personally? Like, what sort of enjoyment or value do you get out of them?
So at this point in my life, with our two kids and, you know, everything that happens with a family, we get to spend time together. Mm-hmm. And that supersedes everything else. Previous to that, I would never have said that I was a gamer. I would say, if somebody said, hey, do you play a lot of board games? I would say, no, I don't play board games. And then I sat down and thought about it, and yeah, we played Uno. We played Monopoly every now and then. We had Operation. We had, like, all these games, like tons and tons of games. But I never categorized myself that way. And I realized that that's probably pretty common, that people play a lot of games but don't really think about how they're playing games. Mm-hmm. It just kind of organically happens once or twice a month or whatever it is, and you end up playing a game with some friends and you have fun and you move on. And I realize that amount of fun is really important. I mean, it brings people together in times that otherwise they may not. And so the ability for us to kind of bring new products to life that where the entire goal is just to bring people together, it felt like the right move for us in terms of just, you know, it's a fun business to get into. Why not?
Yeah.
Let's make it happen.
And what you're talking about in terms of, like, not perceiving yourself as someone who plays a lot of games, I think that also is kind of part and parcel with, in the last handful of decades, the sort of rise of particularly board and card gaming, as like a more intense niche, like, you know, with the rise of Euro games and everything that Settlers of Catan has spawned, where that has created the space of, oh, those are people who quote unquote game, as opposed to Parker Brothers, Milton Bradley, the things that kind of everyone played.
Yeah. And we really think that our products are kind of fall in that second category. Mm-hmm. Like, I went to PAX Unplugged. It's a big game convention, very heavy, mm-hmm. I would say. That and Gen Con are probably the two, like, generally heavier games presented there. There are family games, but it is known for, you know, Wingspan having a huge following and sure. building up there and things like that. All right, so at PAX Unplugged, Floats My Goats is our game about goats who are shipwrecked, and you have to build a raft and get the goats to safety. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a very light strategy game, but that game thrived in that environment, and it was kind of fun to watch these people who play like a lot heavier games all of a sudden really, really get into the passion of sinking or getting rid of somebody else's goat, or,
right.
you know, like messing with their raft. Like, all these little nuances seem to work, even though it's a 20-minute game mm-hmm. and it's not their 3-hour, 4-hour game, right? So when you can bring people together, even if it's a shorter amount of time, I think it opens the door for a lot more people to jump into the hobby. And I think hardcore gamers recognize that and want that. They get to bring their kids to the table more often. They get to bring their neighbor who doesn't really like sitting down for 2 hours. They can come over and join easier. So we definitely see Hootenanny as the, I would say, like, almost gateway game in that view, but also as just a general family fun game. Like, we just want to bring people together to laugh and smile and whatever that takes. Usually it's something family friendly and easy to learn, and we're all just going to be cracking up at whatever it is, cute animals or you name it, right? And that's our goal.
Yeah, and it's more a video game analogy, but it reminds me of the sort of Nintendo mentality of, like, easy to learn, hard to master type space being a really valuable one to inhabit, so that you can have PAX Unplugged crunchy gamers figuring out how best to get goats across a river.
Yeah, there you go. It's perfect. I like that phrase.
And to the point of Snarkus being inspired by a old game, so many of the games that have survived through the centuries are simple but engaging, right?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the games that are in casinos today and you see what people are playing. And I mean, I don't even know most of them, but it's wild to think that these games went from somebody sitting around on their floor, you know, playing with friends and family to being international and sometimes a lot of money bet on it.
And often, like, changing hands so drastically. Like, I don't know if you've ever looked into, like, the history of playing card decks and how, like, there was a period in history where the decks in France had a different composition than the decks in Britain versus in different parts of the world. And then it coalesced into what we now have as, like, the standard playing card deck.
I need to read more about that. That would be of a lot of interest.
Yeah.
If you have any books, recommend them.
Usually YouTube channels.
Okay.
But I'll let you know.
All right. Sounds good.
And then things like chess that have also gone through several iterations and also have, like, globally similar games that couldn't have, like, touched one another. But, like, humans just want to play games. And they, because humans have only so many different kinds of experiences among themselves, they make games about similar kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we see that on the conceptual review stage. Not often, but from time to time, two inventors in very different parts of the world will come to us with almost identical ideas for a game. And we're like, wow, that was really, really close to another game that we were just looking at. It's crazy.
So talking about people bringing concepts, I'm aware of just a couple games in the back of my head where either usually like an initial older printing of a game will have one theming and then a later printing will have a new theming around its mechanics. Are there any concepts that have been brought to you that were either fully devoid of theming and were like, here is a mechanic, or their theming was way different at conception than it is now.
Yeah. So the game that you played, Disco Island Escape, came to us as a really, really cool mechanic of concentric circles.
Yeah.
And you're trying to move your tokens around the board based on cards you draw.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't have a theme. And they said, hey, we don't have a theme. We think it's cool as is, but feel free to add one. Like, I mean, you can do whatever you want with it. And we took it and added lemurs to it and a disco ball. And, like, it became this whole disco dancing-themed lemur game, which is absurd. And part of the reason that I love this industry, because you can do absurd things and somehow it is fine. But then we also have – I'm going to grab this game for a second. So we have Sixum, which is completely unthemed. Martin Nedergaard Anderson invented this game. And it is bingo with dice with an element of sabotage. I mean, it's like the most simple, somehow vicious game that you could ever invent. And we loved it. And it didn't need a theme.
Yeah.
I mean, it was perfect. It's just like playing bingo with dice, but you can like mess with other people's boards. And so sometimes it feels like it should have one, a theme. And sometimes if you feel like, no, this is great without one. Let's let it ride.
Yeah.
So I guess every project's a little different.
Indeed. So you recently went to the New York Toy Fair?
Yeah.
Yeah. How much of your time at events like that is spent like repping your own games versus meeting with people versus scoping out other people's games?
Oh, that's a good question. It is a huge event for the toy industry. I mean, there are tens of thousands of people there, probably close to 1,000 companies like us presenting their goods. A lot of store chains are looking at the next products to put on their shelves. Mm. So the main purpose of that event is sales.
Sure.
It's to meet with buyers who want to buy your product. We also meet with our sales reps there. They're always in attendance. We've got almost 100 sales reps nationwide that sell our product into all 50 states. And, I mean, a lot of the inventors come there, and some of them hung out at our booth and demoed their games to everybody. So it was super fun just to be in the presence of all these people who are really all after the common theme of promoting their toy or game company.
Yeah. So is that more on the sort of industry side of the spectrum versus like a PAX Unplugged or a Gen Con that's at least more focused on like an individual gamer coming in and checking things out?
Yeah. So PAX Unplugged and Gen Con are consumer events. Mm-hmm. You could buy a ticket and go. You don't have to be in the industry. But for Toy Fair, you have to have some credentials that get you in, whether you're a toy company or a manufacturer or whatever it is. You could be a member of the press, but you have to have credentials to get you in the door. In fact, I don't even think they let children into Toy Fair.
Sure.
Unless you're an influencer, and then you're good. But even that, you have to have like a threshold.
Right.
20,000 followers. I don't know what it is, but it's some number.
You must be this metaphorically tall to
exactly.
enter.
Exactly.
So since entering this space with Big G and now, what are games that come to mind for you that do things in a unique way, like the things that you haven't seen other games do?
All right. So first of all, since we started this company, we have had the plan to play a lot of, I'll say competitors, but really other companies' games. Like
sure.
We're all in this rising tide, right?
I mean, yeah. Everyone who plays games ideally likes to play lots of games.
Yeah. And we promote any game that we like, whether we make it or not. So that said, our goal was to play a lot of other games that weren't ours. Once we really delved into this, we realized that we play so many concepts of games that we don't have a ton of time to like go buy a game off the shelf and play it. That said, we still do buy a lot of games and we eventually play them, but our time has been eaten up by playing prototypes, which are super cool but may not have artwork or, you know. And we're thinking about it from a little different perspective. But games that we love in our house, I mean, Game Right has been doing a good job for a long time. Quicks is a great little dice game.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing things like that where you're like, this game is so simple and yet can entertain people for hours. Like that, any mechanic that kind of has that draw is really interesting to us. Another one of theirs is Rat-A-Tat-Cat. Our kids love this game. I mean, we love it too, but anytime the kids want to play a decent game, we're all in. So what else do we play? Kids play chess. They have an after-school club once a week where they play chess. So it's fun to sit down and, you know, play my second-grade boys in a game of chess.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, we play pretty much Carcassonne. They love that. My 8-year-old is a huge fan of Carcassonne.
Nice.
And he always wins. And he's like he's the least competitive out of the four of us. But when we play that game, he somehow manages to beat us every time.
Mm. Yeah, sometimes people just find their game.
Yeah, he found it.
And it is also always nice when a lot of games are obviously very skill-based, whether that is a dexterity game that is a physical skill or a strategy game that's a mental skill. But so many games seem like they try and balance out skill with luck sufficiently to like keep the entire table interested so that not everyone has to be on the same skill level. Have you seen any specific amount of that going into these games?
So we have a game that's coming out this summer that has it's a kids game kind of in the world of a lot of games that are out there, high energy, super fun. I won't give away too much. Check it out later. So this game, we put a little mechanism, or I guess it was pitched to us with a mechanism that we really liked, where every so often you would have to change hands of cards with the player next to you.
Oh.
And so no matter how well you're doing, if somebody throws this one card out, all of a sudden you have to change cards with somebody else. And it can just absolutely even the playing field. It does a really good job of that. And sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not good, but you know it can always happen, so you have to be aware.
Yeah, and obviously not knowing anything about the other mechanics, but it sounds like that would incentivize people to not, like, stockpile. Like, if you have a good thing, you got to do it now.
Yeah, it makes you race faster. Mm-hmm. Like, the goal of this game is to get rid of all your cards.
Okay.
So you know if you don't have one of those cards that somebody else probably does, and so you're like, okay, I better do this as quickly as I can.
Yeah, and just the table awareness. I feel like a lot of the discussion around tabletop gaming in general is, for a lot of people, the game is good if you continue to be aware that there are other people around the table, right? As opposed to it becoming just you focused on the board and how best you are interacting with the board, being aware of the other people and what they're doing.
Yeah, and honestly, one of the most crucial things when we are pitched a game is, what are you doing when it's not your turn, right? And so that's the biggest question in most games, because most games are turn-taking. Now, that new game that we're about to launch is not turn-taking, so that's a whole nother interesting factor. But when you are sitting there waiting for somebody else to make their move, you should not be sitting there waiting, is our goal and philosophy.
Yeah.
So, like, if somebody pitches us an awesome game, but you feel like you're kind of stalled until your next move, we usually send it back to them and say, hey, it's really close. How can we remedy this? And a lot of times they're like, oh, great, great idea. Let's do X, Y, and Z. And it solves it. Sometimes you're like, well, you know, it's just, you know, ups and downs in a game. Yeah. I'd rather keep it more consistent.
Are there any of the current lineup that come to mind in terms of, like, a more significant design journey than others?
So when Floats My Goats was initially created, these inventors are, it's a husband-wife team, Sarah and Brian. They are fantastic. They go by the name Galactic Sneeze. Huge fans of them. I think this was their first non-party game.
Okay.
So everything that they do is hilarious and usually rated R. And they are just the funniest human beings in the world. And they pitched us this game, and it has, I mean, it's very light strategy. It had this name, Floats McGoats, which is a great name. And we were playing it, and it just felt like there was a little too much back and forth. Like, you could one step forward, two steps back. And that's a great, great way to play a game, but it needed just a tweak about it.
Sure.
And we said, hey, do you have any ideas about that? And they're like, yeah, how about this? And they just shot it right back to us. We're going to add a thing on the one side of the die that says flip a stick so one of your raft sticks can become permanent.
Oh.
And so nobody can move that for the rest of the game. And that one little change made all the difference.
Mm.
And so all of a sudden a game was over, you know, 5 or 10 minutes sooner than it was beforehand. And so that, it kept the excitement level up. You always want the game to end at an exciting point.
Like, yeah.
You don't want to peak and then wait a little bit and then the game's over, right? You want the peak to be when the game's over. And so that's always a part of it. But they, I mean, sometimes these inventors are just so close to a game that they can just come up with something right off the top of their head. I mean, it's wild. Very impressive.
And it sounds like, I don't remember if you've used this word to this point already, it sounds like your role in a lot of cases is almost like an editor, like an editor of a novel or something akin to that. Or a lot of the people that I've talked to so far have been in roles where they are kind of championing things. Like I've talked to the owners of a small bookstore and they have to curate their collection. I just talked to a curator from the Frist Art Museum, and obviously you are championing and collating art there. And it sounds like your role is not dissimilar in like finding the heart of these ideas and making it shine as brightly as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. It's probably the most important role that we have is picking which games we can thrive with. It might be an incredible game mechanic that is just not us for some reason. Maybe our sales team wouldn't get behind it for one reason or another. Maybe it's too young, too old, whatever it is. There are a million reasons. But if it fits us as a brand and we can theme it and get the art direction just right with our graphics team and we can push it from a marketing standpoint with our PR team. And, you know, we know who's interested in products like ours at this point. And so if all of those pieces fall into place, we can make this rock, right? Like we feel confident in that. Not 100%, right? There's always always times when we think something's incredible and other people may be less excited by it. I think that's just human nature. But most of the time when we have enough eyeballs on something to where we can usually weed out something.
Sure.
If we are super passionate about it, but we're the only people passionate about it. So everything gets play tested to the max, both informally and formally. So first of all, if our kids don't like a game, it usually ends right there. Because we want our family to be able to sit around and enjoy every game that we create.
Sure.
And even if it's an awesome game, if our kids are like, that game stinks, then we're pretty much, we've lost all the wind in our sails. So
they are the most important shark.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a no from us.
And then after that, we take it to a whole lot more diverse group of people to evaluate and refine it. But yeah, it starts with the kids.
Sure.
Always.
In terms of that understanding of your lane as Hoot Nanny and the kinds of games that work for you and your audience that you've developed, have you seen at these like trade shows and as much comparables as you're able to do, is that how the successful folks succeed, is in the understanding of a lane rather than sort of diversification of the space?
Yeah, I think to some extent that's got to be true. There are so many games out there, and there's so many different categories even, that you really have to decide where you're going to devote your time and energy to do the best work. For us, we launched 4 initial games in our company, and we wanted to not cannibalize any of those top 4 game or first 4 games. So we made a card game, a dice game, a party game, and a light strategy game. And we felt like having 4 games in 4 different categories would help us pick up customers across a wider range and get them learning about us as a brand. Now, once those first 4 were out, we were less cautious about that. We've got, you know, a family party game. We've got another light strategy game. We've got, you know, so we're kind of in this world where you're eventually going to have 2 games in the same subcategory of product. So, and if they're good, then that's more reason for somebody to play one, enjoy it, and try the next one, right? So we're not going to diversify really beyond where we are at this point, I don't think. we always get asked, hey, are you going to make an app? You going to make a video game? And I have no idea. Maybe someday, but we don't have time to, you know, we don't have as much time in the day as we would like at this point in our life. So maybe at some point, if things get easier and, you know, we've got a few more hours each day, we can try something new.
Yeah. Wouldn't we all like that? Yeah. In terms of like not cannibalizing. There's only so many different ways you can combine the different elements to where, like, obviously, Disco Island, I assume that's what you're referring to as, like, the other light strategy game, but it's also card-based to a non-insignificant degree. So there's the combination of elements that happens. I think that is one of the things that makes the tabletop space so vast, is that there are a limited number of ways to interact with these things, but if you combine them in new ways... It's like music genres. Like, you can just take any two words and plug them together. That's a genre now.
Yeah, it is. And we were a little questionable of how to proceed. Like, once we had our first four games in four different categories, where do we go from here? There's dexterity games. There's all these little other places that you can go.
Yeah. And the sophomore album problem.
Yeah, and what price points do you want to hit? Like, what customers do you want to cater to? Like, do you want all the same type of buyer? Do you want the same age buyer? Do you want, you know, like, there are a lot of, and if you're going to do something, you've got to do it great. Like, you don't want to underperform, and particularly jumping into a space that maybe is a little to the side of where you were before. Mm. And so you want to do your research, make sure it's excellent, right? So we relied on a lot of we ask a lot of people questions. Mm. Like, we ask our salespeople, like, hey, what's selling the best for you right now? We ask the stores that carry our games, what's selling the best for you? What are people most excited about? Like, what games really bring people to your store? Like, when somebody walks in the door and they say, hey, do you have X, Y, and Z? Like, what is that question? Mm. And that's really important to us, because we want to know who's doing a good job, who's spreading the word well, who's and not copy any of that, right? But understand what consumers want and try to give them a better version of that, whatever it is. So an example is, we just released this game, Feeling Cute, mm-hmm. and it is all about ranking cute animals. Mm-hmm. And it probably takes 10 seconds to explain the gameplay, okay? But kids love this game. Like, the playtesting on this game was absolutely incredible. Everybody just wants to keep playing it. And it's not just kids. Like, we think this is a kids game. And so adults are kind of hesitant to walk in and, like, okay, we'll play this little game. And then you realize that it's about ranking the cuteness of each different animal in the game. Mm. And everybody, adults, kids, everybody in between, has a favorite animal and a least favorite animal and the whole spectrum of what's cuter than what in their mind. And nobody agrees. And that's what makes this game work, is that everybody has these different life experiences and these different biases. And so once our team came to us and said, hey, you know, there's animals that are super hot, or like anything about dogs or cats or mm-hmm. whatever, like, we can sell anything. And we saw this awesome game, and we were like, yeah, let's try it. You know, like, all these pieces of information kind of came together at the perfect moment to just snatch it up and try to create it and bring it to market.
Yeah.
But yeah, so far it's feeling cute. It's great. Doing well.
Good. And obviously, like, in any creative pursuit where, like, there is an audience involved, because sometimes it's just a thing you make for you when you make stuff. But anytime there is an audience involved, being aware of that audience and, like, who to show it to, and, like, making sure that they understand what you're trying to do is paramount. Have there been instances where that balance has been hard to strike between, like, maybe a time that just the tastes of your sons is more specific than say, a broader audience you're looking for? Has there been a striking of balance on occasion?
I mean, I think it's always going to be some question of, how representative is this sample?
Right.
But, you know, we try to solve that by getting a really nailed down idea of who would be the perfect consumer for that game. Mm. And then going and finding those people and saying, hey, will you play this game? And sitting down and just kind of see what they say about it.
Yeah.
And we get great feedback. People are not afraid to tell you what they think about a product. Sometimes, like, you walk away with your tail between your legs and you're like, wow, I didn't realize this was that bad. And then other times you walk away, like, with feeling cute. We're like, oh, my gosh, they ate that up.
Right.
They loved it. We gotta do more of it. Like, let's add more cards. Let's make it a bigger game. Let's make it more fun. Let's do, it energizes you, right? Like, to see other people who are really the end user of this game get excited about something. At one point, we had a young girl who was playtesting this game, and there's a fennec fox in here.
Yeah.
And that, the big ears.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's her favorite animal. And she saw it, and she was like, oh, my gosh, I'm keeping this card. It's the cutest thing ever. And she, like, stuck it in her pocket and ran away. And we're like, no, this is just a prototype. I promise you, we'll send you a free copy of this game once it comes out. But I need that. She was like, no, I'm keeping it.
That's so funny. I think that experience is also not dissimilar to a lot of other creative pursuits where you're, like, mixing an album 50 ways to Sunday until, like, you're so sick of it. How do you, while playtesting, or do you have to keep a distance from like the fact that you have played this 50 million times?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's about your circle, both personally and professionally. In our case, we take each game to people that we know and have them try out games. Like, if we think that this game would be perfect for their family, we will take it to them and say, hey, can y'all try this game out? And we'll just kind of sit back and be there,
right?
But we'll also hire people that are outside of our immediate space and bring in consultants who are rules editors and things like that, right? And sometimes, as you would expect, the friends are more kind about things than consultants can be. Even though you're paying them, they're like, you got to change this. This is terrible. And so having both of those views is really helpful. And usually once we've gone through all the efforts on that from both perspectives, it ends up making the game 100 times better.
Yeah.
I mean, just little rules nuances can really change a game.
Mm.
So, I mean, we spend a lot of time on rules, and usually it's the very last thing we send to the factory to manufacture.
Yeah,
it's like, here's all the artwork for the entire game. Here's all the components, the box, everything. Rules will come next week.
Right. It's like, you got to do a few more playtests, make sure there's not that one edge case that you need to make a rule about.
Oh, my gosh. And there always is some, I don't know, if you've played a game where people just do the wrong thing on purpose. And you're like, you're about to win. Like, if you go right, you win. If you go left, you lose. And they're like, oh, just go left and see what happens.
Yeah, just want to keep playing longer.
Like, no.
We'll just play again. It's fine. Play the game right.
So anyways, you have to rule things like that out. Like, you can't just make a game break because somebody's ignorant to some philosophy of the game. So anyways, it's fun. We always have, plenty of people that we can rely on to, we're like, hey, play this game wrong and see how it works.
Break it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the equivalent, you might also just call it QA, but I'm thinking of, like, video game industry, the people who work 8 hours a day, like, trying to break games to see if someone at home will break the game in the same way.
Oh, yeah. So QA for us is usually the, like, physical side of it, because we have to make sure every token is perfect and, the foil is stamped on correctly and, like... Yeah, but that's definitely the rules editing that is so tedious. And it's fun at the beginning of the project, but at the end you're like, okay, we need to wrap these up.
Right. And this space in particular with board games, tactility is such a huge factor of it, of its uniqueness and the appeal of, like, when you're playing chess, if you have something that's nicer than, like, a $5 plastic set, you can just sort of mull on the piece and it's part of the game.
Oh, yeah.
But I imagine from a, like, production standpoint, it's like when you're choosing the napkins for your wedding on steroids, of, like, how many different colors and textures and things you're testing it out.
So there's a really, I think this story gets told too much around us, but I'll tell it anyways. When we were making Snarkus, we had a foil book from our factory
yeah.
with every possible foil that you could use.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, I had to grab that out of Whitney's hands and tell her she was not allowed to use any more foil. I mean, if you go through that game, there's, I think one of the gems mm-hmm. has like five different foils on it. I was like, you realize that every one of these adds to the cost of the product, right?
Yeah.
So, but it made it cool. It made it stand out.
That is certainly the thing I think about when I think about Snarkus.
Yeah, those gems, they're real shiny.
Mm. And even, you know, the Disco Island box is just sort of sitting on a table in my basement right now. And every time I walk by it, the eyes on the lemurs on the side of the box just sort of light up at me. And I go, whoa.
Yeah, one thing about that game, mm-hmm. I don't know if you realize this, but each of the lemurs has a name.
Yes.
Yeah, Frank, Uma, Norm, and Kate.
Mm.
And the first initial spells funk.
Ah, yeah. So it does. That's cute.
A little Easter egg in there.
Tag yourself.
Yeah, there you go. I also have a brother-in-law named Frank. Mm. My sister's name is Catherine, but mm-hmm. at one point in life, she went by Kate. So it was kind of funny. We didn't even come up with those names.
Oh, no.
I think Statement, maybe we did. I don't know. Statement put names around the board at one point. We were like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Way to go.
I feel like, yeah, there's often a balance that gets struck in games that are less, like, drastically themed, shall we say, where, like, sometimes there are games where it feels like they're trying to inject too much plot into a game that isn't plot-driven. And I think something like Disco Island strikes a nice balance there of, like, there's enough flavor for you to sort of latch on to the lemurs having names as opposed to, like, a game where you're playing cards in very rapid succession and they all have flavor text on them for some reason that I'm never going to read. And that can be a distraction. So it seems like that is a balancing act as well of like how much adds to engagement versus creating distraction.
Yeah, and some of that is age related too,
sure.
right? Like the younger kids probably care more about the dance moves that are mentioned on the cards, right? And it's one word. It's not like a whole lot of stuff. But the more strategic people that play that game probably don't need to read that, you know?
But it is in the rules that if they play the one card, they must do a disco dance.
That's right. You must dance if you draw the boogie to safety card. That's right.
I drew like three of those myself in the first time we played.
Wow. At a certain point, it's cheating. There's only three out of 108 cards, or four out of 108 cards.
I did wonder. Now I know.
Yeah, that's wild. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's hard to do.
Yeah. I would say I should have bought a lottery ticket, but I think I spent it all up, all that energy. Well, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah. Thank you, Matt. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah. It's an enjoyable selection of games. We have a couple in our library board game collection if anyone wants to check it out before they buy.
Yeah. We will bring some more in, make sure the library's fully stocked.
Yeah. Because if anyone listening was not aware, the library does have a board game collection.
I'm about to go check it out right after this.
A lot of stuff's on the shelf down there right now. Like, sometimes it's more barren. You can kind of tell when it's holiday time because all the board games are getting checked out. But there's a lot of good stuff down there right now.
Okay.
And thank you all so much for listening. As always, this podcast is brought to you because of the Nashville Public Library. So, if you're listening out there, whether you're in Nashville or beyond, find your public library, get a library card, and use it. The best way to support your public library is to let it support you with all the goods and services that they offer. I bet there's more than you think. Thank you very much.